Double Loop Podcast, your source for everything about fingerprints while you're working on your comparisons. We'll talk about comparisons. I'm Eric Ray.
And I'm Glenn Langenberg.
Hey, Glenn. It's been a few weeks since we recorded, but since we built up, you know, so many episodes there around the beginning of the year, we're sitting pretty here.
Yeah, I know. We're, again, keeping up with our New Year's resolution of putting out more episodes each year.
Well, let's start off with a big thank you to some new patrons. So you can go to patreon.com/doubleloop podcast if you also want to send a couple bucks our way. But big thank yous to Jack, Rebecca, and Mandy. Really appreciate you guys joining our little club here and helping us do all the things that we do.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So we got an email from Simon Cole. I'm sure many of you know Simon Cole's name. And
I know that guy.
Right. He was referenced in one of our episodes that we dropped yes. a month or two ago on the AI studies, which I don't know if you've testified in this time period, Eric. Have you been asked about it or heard about anyone asked about the AI paper that fingerprints were disproved to be unique?
Nope. I had a potential testimony a few weeks ago, so maybe a few weeks to a month after the big paper came out, but they stipulated. So yeah, no one seemed to care about that particular topic.
I have testified a record six times in the last 3 weeks. I actually testified three times in 1 week, a Monday, Tuesday, and a Wednesday, three different cases, completely different situations. And these are not negative results. These are all like IDs and
Motions. Yeah, same jurisdiction or different states?
Different states. Yeah, it has been insane.
Wow.
Not been asked about it at all.
Yeah. What did they say? Tempest in a teapot? Is that what Christoph said? Yeah.
But we got an email from Simon who had listened to the episode because we had mentioned him in the episode. We quoted him and appreciated some of his comments in his, I believe, CNN article. And what he said was a great episode. I learned a lot from a very thorough analysis of the article. And thanks for the shout out. You're welcome, Simon. He said that when the press was calling, I was trying to figure out a good citation for where the fact of intra-individual similarity was stated in the literature. A lot of the hereditability studies seemed to just take it for granted and not explicitly say that. Yeah. And he said that he didn't think of the Ullery paper, which is what we cited, and said, nice catch. And I actually had the same problem. When I was preparing for that episode, I reached out to Alice White. Like, hey, Alice, you know, where? Just start sending me the paper so I can find a written. And she's like, I'm not sure anyone is saying it explicitly. So we have that same sort of, we know it, but where is it actually written down? But Simon came up with a citation, which is pretty great. And so he sent it to us and said that the best site that he came up with was the Bonnevie paper, Christine Bonnevie from 1924. She published a study called Studies on Papillary Patterns of Human Fingers in Journal of Genetics from 1924, as he notes, almost a century ago. And she says the following. It seems evident from this table that there exists some coincidence between the quantitative values of the various fingers of one and the same individual, the patterns representing either relatively low or relatively high values. The individual values may therefore be considered of characteristic of the individual itself, not only as the sum of the varying finger values. So point being is that she noted that there were these similarities within the same source and published it 100 years ago.
Yeah, it was great that it was exactly 100 years ago.
Nice catch, Simon. Thank you for sharing that. And that, yeah, that's exactly the biological citation we were looking for. And as we had said in that episode, that this was something that was known, but it was a matter of finding it being cited somewhere. And now we have at least a couple of citations.
I think it just seemed so obvious that no one bothered to say it. The research is showing that identical twins, you know, have prints that are more common than a fraternal or normal siblings. Or more distant family members, then there's an implication that just the fingers between each other are. And I guess the other one where it just seems too obvious to just even bother stating it, but maybe some of like the friction ridge frequency studies of, there might be some data in there as well showing how fingers from the same person have a very similar ridge frequency.
So that was actually a sort, like the Gutierrez papers, for example. But what I found was they pooled everything together. And once you pool it, you're not getting that intra-source variability.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they're putting things by pattern and things by finger, but not by person. That's where you're going to lose that level of information.
So I've been looking into this topic for a whole different reason recently. And there's a whole bunch of papers on frequency dating back almost 100 years as well. So there's definitely a lot to sort through to see if anything's in there. But anyway, the paper that Simon sent was, again,
Bonnevie.
B-O-N-N-E-V-I-E. That was actually a reference I'd never seen before. So I was, you know, doubly happy to now add it to my collection.
I hadn't seen this original paper, but I've read Bonnevie's work when I was working on my thesis, because Bonnevie is mentioned in Cummins and Midlow. They make references to her work and Sarah Holt's work. So I know I've seen like the results of her various studies, but never the original paper. So it really was a nice reference to have the original.
Yeah. All right, Glenn, you going to take me somewhere around the world today?
I am. This one's pretty easy, so I have to try to make it a little bit harder for you, a little more difficult.
Okay.
All right, so let's start with, it's an island country, although it is split into smaller countries. Halloween was invented here. In fact, the festival of Samhain comes from there, although it's spelled Samhain, but it's pronounced Samhain.
Okay.
10% of the people in this country have red hair, which is the highest of any country. Compared to other countries, it tends to be about 1%, so it's quite a high proportion. It is the only country with a musical instrument as part of the country's national symbol, which is a harp. It has 30,000 castles and ruins, and I thought you'd appreciate these next two. Transporter Chief Miles O'Brien came from this country on Star Trek The Next Generation. And Star Wars Episodes 7 through 9 had scenes that were filmed there. This country is?
That'd be Ireland.
That would be Ireland.
Yes, yeah, definitely the Emerald an easy Isle. One. Yeah. I'm all just instantly thinking of different movies. The Commitments
mentioned. That's one of my favorites.
I love The Commitments.
It really is.
You'd mentioned the Miles O'Brien, and who's in that movie as well.
Yeah, the father.
And yeah. Anyway, no, that is on my absolute short list for countries to visit here in the next few years, hopefully.
Fantastic.
So, yeah. And if you go down the right family path, it eventually traces back towards Scotch-Irish descent, and got to quite a few family members with that red hair. So,
Yeah. Yeah, I had Ireland on the brain. I'm leaving for Detroit in a few days to go visit my friends on my annual trip for St. Patrick's Day. Also, I watched the Oscars last night, and congratulations to Cillian Murphy. I love him as an actor, and I remember seeing him first in, of course, 28 Days Later, and he won the Oscar for Oppenheimer, which I really enjoyed. So congratulations to the Irish. It's their month.
Yeah, it actually is. My wife and I signed up for a cooking class. It was like a date night thing here next weekend, and I think it's the day before St. Patrick's Day. And the dish that weekend is corned beef and cabbage. So my wife has always hated corned beef cabbage because her dad would make it when she was a kid for St. Patrick's Day, and it was always terrible. So I convinced her by saying, well, let's learn how to make it the right way. I'm sure if you make it properly, it's really good.
Well, I mean, all Irish food is either boiled or deep fried. So there you go.
All right. Well, Glenn, I've been asked a couple times, when are you guys going to talk about this whole Texas Commission thing? When are you guys going to talk about the Texas Commission thing?
Never.
People with this kind of look on their face, like they can't wait to do that, sit back with a bag of popcorn and watch the, the drama unfold. So, well, here's the episode where we're going to talk about the Texas Commission thing. I don't think it's going to be quite the drama that some people might be expecting, but
right.
I'm glad we're finally going to be able to to get to this. Boy, we definitely have teased it for quite a few months now since making references to it a little bit back in our IAI episode.
But I'm also glad that we did, right? Because yes. Now the report is out, and so we can use the report.
Yes.
And while there was, you know, some emotion that seemed to be running high last year at the conference, and around that time period, some time has passed, some things have, you know, changed, you know, life has moved on. And so now I think we can look at it a little more dispassionately.
Yes.
We'll see. But I admittedly, I mean, you know, you and I have talked about this and I don't want to share too much here, but my participation in this case ended up being a lot more stressful and it took a bigger toll than I expected it to because of the emotional elements of it. I mean, I got involved thinking, well, this would be fairly straightforward. I'll just be able to offer some advice this way and this way, and I'll just do my thing and I'll just look at it, you know, as a neutral outsider. But I was very surprised at how it didn't really go that way. But I guess what I'll say here is there was a lot that went on behind the scenes, but I will just bear that because there's no need to really talk about it because it the report has come out. It's not a part of the report. We're just going to all move forward. And I hope we can all move forward with the report because it's the report that matters. That's what matters to me, at least. And ultimately, in the state of Texas, it's what will matter to practitioners in Texas. So yeah. All, like you were just, you know, referring to, like all this emotional part and the drama and all that, we're not really going to talk about that because it's not relevant. It's not public anymore, really. I mean, for all intents and purposes, and it's not a part of the report. So there, that's all we're saying on the drama. If you tuned in for the drama, be ready to be disappointed.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that, and again, this is partly coming just from conversations we've had over the past months, you know, seems to come from, you know, some members of the commission that seem to take a calm, you know, more, let's look at the facts, let's discuss this, you know, in a reasonable way and come to a reasonable report that seeks to improve the work that's going on in Texas and hopefully beyond Texas in regards to latent print examinations.
Yeah, and that's actually a really good point, Eric, because it was one of the reasons I even signed up to be involved was I was already very familiar with the Texas Commission, Forensic Science Commission, because I had read their DNA report from the Austin lab. Mm. And I was very familiar with their approach. They had a bite mark report as well. And what was clear to me was they were not necessarily about, all right, well, who's to blame for all of this?
Yeah.
It wasn't about that. It was about what happened and what recommendations can we make to go forward to improve practices in the state of Texas. And that's what I liked. I really appreciated their thoughtfulness and their thoroughness in the DNA and the bite mark ones in Texas. So I had already that knowledge going into it, and that's why I was actually even interested when they approached me and said, hey, we're looking for a subject matter expert. Here's the elements. Are you interested? It was actually a very easy yes, because I have appreciated what you have done in the past for other disciplines.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yep.
All right. So I've got here a little, you know, rundown of the events of the case. So this is much more of a just the facts, ma'am, type of summary of what happened in this case before we get into the report and recommendations and, you know, Glenn's involvement and all that, just to catch everyone up on, you know, what happened in the criminal investigation and the trial before this whole commission got involved.
You know, 10% of our listeners will not get the reference, just the facts, ma'am.
Just the facts. Only 10%? Are you kidding?
No, I was highballing you.
Yeah, I don't even make the reference unless I'm you know, confident that half the people won't get it. Yeah. All right. So this dates back to a 2001 homicide. So in 2001, Josephine Herbert is killed, and as part of the evidence collected at the crime scene, a latent palm print is found on a curved metal pole near the body, and it appears to have a matrix of suspected blood. And a crime scene specialist named Debbie Benningfield is one of the folks that responds to the scene. And at the scene, she takes multiple photos from different angles of the latent print. Remember, it's on a curved surface, so you need different lighting conditions. You want to, you know, you might not get all of the detail in just one shot, so you take multiple photos around this curved surface.
So just little minor points here of detail. You know, you did say latent print on there. Technically, it was in like a visible impression, but they did do enhancement at the scene. I can't tell from the black and white photos if there are any photographs before the enhancement, but there are definitely photographs after the enhancement with Amido Black.
Got it.
Debbie technically didn't take the photographs herself. It was a police officer under her direction.
Okay. Oh, no, that's important. Clarification. So, I mean,
whether or not
Thank
those little
that.
Things matter or not, but yes, little elements there.
And yeah, and I'm probably going to keep referring to it as a latent, you know, like this whole episode.
To mean unknown,
the more, you know, colloquial Fair. Term that we use, not its relevant or its, you know, visibility before or after development, but yeah, in that unknown sense.
Yeah, and they were using 35mm camera, and so
it's
there
2001.
Are... Right, exactly. Digital is still just emerging at this time and was very new to our field.
And but the pole was taken from the crime scene and mm-hmm. taken to the DEA office in Dallas. And in the report, it mentions how digital photos were taken there at the DEA office, but because of technology and being very new overall, those photos ended up being just under 400 PPI. So, you know, definitely not at the 1,000 PPI standard we have now, not even at the 500 PPI resolution that you typically get for temprint records, you know, even less than that.
Yeah, and I'm not even sure that the latent print 1,000 PPI standard came into play until, like, I was on SqueakFast when we made the recommendation, so it must have been like 2005.
Okay.
So it wouldn't even existed back then. There would not have been a SqueakFast standard indicating digital evidence in 2001.
Yeah, no, I've never actually looked into that. IAFIS started in 1999, and, you know, obviously 500 was already a standard at that point for 10 prints, but I've never actually even looked into at what point is a standard set for latents, and when is that, you know, upped to 1,000 PPI.
I recall vividly in my early sessions at SqueakFast, us deciding what we would be putting in a standard, so it obviously didn't exist before that, so it had to be in 2005. It may have existed, in fact, it might have existed in Swigit, SWGIT, but it wasn't part of SwigFast until at least 2005.
You know, I bet you Ed would know. And I bet you it may have even been in before, you know, the NIST standards before it was even in Swigit. But so all in all, after the homicide, as the investigation continues, Houston PD is asked to compare that latent, and they eventually compare it to 51 different suspects. And no ID or no identification was the result for all those comparisons to all 50-plus suspects.
An interesting thing, too, is that Houston Police Department at that time, not accredited. There's a whole other separate issue with what was going on at Houston Police Department at the time. But they didn't issue reports on negatives. So only when they had an identification would they issue a report. So a lot of these conclusions would be like a list and they were checked off, but not necessarily ever would issue a report saying, yep, excluded, or at the time would have been not identified, no identifications to this person, that one. They just had a list that they kept ticking off, but not issuing reports.
So skip ahead to 2009. And there is a CODIS hit to two people in this case, to Joseph Webster. And that is a hit to DNA collected from underneath the fingernails or the fingernail clippings of the victim. Mm-hmm. And also to Lorenzo Jones, whose DNA was found on the shirt of the victim. Now, the victim in this case was Josephine Herbert, was a sex worker. And both of those individuals, Webster and Jones, said that they may have had sex with her because they had, you know, frequented sex workers in that area, but they insisted that they did not kill her. So that is a potential explanation as to why their DNA was present on the victim.
Right. Putting more attention and probative value on this palm print.
Exactly. Even more, I mean, already starts really high when there's possibly has a matrix of blood, but yes, even more so when the DNA is not definitive in the case. So around the same time, in the looks like in the 2009 to 2014 timeframe, there are a number of issues found at the Houston PD, well, forensics unit overall, but also including the latent print unit. I believe it was the DNA and latent print units that had the main issues that were found, and all sorts of changes and everything that had happened at that point with Houston.
Yeah, DNA had a huge scandal that snowballed into all the other sections.
And so in those years, Ron Smith and Associates was contracted to have examiners come in, work cases, you know, in Houston PD. And so I was one of the examiners that came through that lab a few times. I think I had three sessions out there. They were like, I don't know, 9-10 day stretches, working every day. And, you know, it's set up as a kind of an assembly line, right? Someone's working on analysis all day, hand it over to somebody else who does APHIS all day. And there's, you know, reviews at each step. So after analysis, someone comes in, double checks that your analysis is correct. After comparison, obviously there's verification, but, you know, lots of comparisons getting done in that time frame from contractors coming in. And I mean, I would assume all certified, you know, very qualified examiners coming in to do this work.
Yeah. And I mean, a couple of points is that this had never happened before in the history of the profession. There had never been such a contracting takeover for one of the largest metropolitan agencies in the United States with one of the highest crime rates, with literally thousands of cases to go through and backlog and hundreds of contract workers coming through over, you know, 5-6 year period. So, I mean, it's a pretty incredible operation that they took on to basically take over and then keep up with cases coming in, as well as the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of cases backlog.
Oh, yeah. As you entered in, you walked past the shelves of the backlog, right? Where not even just the latents, but just the, you know, like the envelopes of, you know, listing off, here's all the cases that need to be gone through. And it's just this just wall of work. And, you know, it's the old, how do you eat an elephant? Like one bite at a time. Just start in on it and slowly work your way through, not slowly, but as quickly as possible, work your way through the whole thing. And in this whole period, the way it was set up was there was a project manager kind of in charge there at the site. And you know, you'd come in, you'd do your work, and you know, there were forms to fill out for all the results that you had. And then the project manager was the one though responsible. So let's say a case needed to go to court, you're told was, you know, here's, you do all this work, you don't have to worry about the court part, because who knows, this might be 2 years from now that it gets called into court. The project manager will go and do the testimony on the cases that you're working on here in the Houston building. So in 2010, the case comes through, and Ron Smith and Associates, now doing all this work at Houston, is asked to take a look at this case again. So in November of 2010, one of the examiners with Ron Smith and Associates reports out comparison to these 50 some odd individuals to what's called latent one or L1 in the case, and reaches a conclusion of non-identification to all of these people. There may be a couple of exceptions. There is a request for more additional exemplars from a few people, but, you know, not to any of the people that are, you know, the key person in this case, which we'll get to here in a minute, is Joseph Webster. The new exemplars for him is not requested at this time. Those results are verified a few days later at the end of November, searched in the local Harris County, Houston fingerprint or APHIS database in December, searched across the entire Texas APHIS database later that year, the next year in July of 2011, and then finally tech reviewed at the end of July 2011.
Right. So I think it's worth discussing a moment this idea of non-ident. That was technically the conclusion, non-ident. And I think this is where there's a little bit of debate going on. And I want to make sure for our podcast and our record, I mean, non-ident is vernacular in our field, and non-ident is very East Coast. It's what the FBI used to say in the 90s and early 2000s. When they did a comparison and didn't find anything that matched, they would say non-ident. And it was a term that was often used to mean nothing matching, but it wasn't quite exclusion. And we need to make that very subtle distinction. In fact, the way I look at it is it's a little bit like not guilty versus found innocent. These are, right, in the legal world, these are slightly different things. Just because someone's found not guilty doesn't necessarily mean they're innocent. It just means not guilty. Our field had this viewpoint back then where we focused solely on identifications. It was all about the identification. So you either ID'd someone, maybe you didn't find anything a match, you said non-ident. Eric, I don't know if you and I have discussed this before, but you know, one of my favorite little trivia questions is, when did the word exclusion first show up in our literature? And I don't know if you know the answer offhand. You probably do.
Yeah, so but, I really want to dig back into the all these old documents that I pulled 10 plus years ago when I first started talking about exclusions. But if you go back and you look at the old Twigfast, so before Swigfast, there was Twigfast.
Yep.
If you go look at the old Twigfast documents, it lists off the conclusions that you can reach as identification, non-identification, and essentially need better knowns.
And non-identification, in that term of Twigfast, which came right out of the FBI, this was FBI language. This
Absolutely.
Is what the FBI was
language.
Teaching. This is what everybody who was kind of from that old school approach, this is what the language that they were using was non-identification. So exclusion does not show up in any literature until 2002. Yeah. It was first drafted in a Swigfast document in 2002, and I think maybe came official in 2003. If you look through Eschbaugh's entire book on ASB, right, quantitative, qualitative, friction analysis, you will not find the word exclusion. It doesn't exist in his book.
I think. I'm going to have to double check and go back. It's been a few years since I actually looked at those old documents. But I want to say that the definitions were almost exactly the same. But it seemed to me, and again, I wasn't around at the time, but it seemed to me in reviewing, going back and looking at these, that after the initial Dobbs cases in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, your Yara Plaza, your, what was the first one? The
Mitchell.
Mitchell. I always want to say Mayfield. I get Mayfield and Mitchell always mixed up. The Mitchell case, after a few of those, there seemed to be this kind of zeitgeist of we need to kind of science things up around here. You know, the old terminology is just not cutting it. And we need to come across as more scientific. So,
I remember right when that happened. It was the Havard case out of Indiana in 2001. Steve Meager from the FBI and Swigfast went to that case, came back and said, we got to get our terminology straight. Because I just watched firearms, handwriting, footwear go through Daubert hearings, and our language is all over the place. And that's when individualization and exclusion were both introduced. And it came out of the Havard case, H-A-V-V-A-R-D, from Indiana.
And there was almost a straight line, not quite, but almost a straight line equivalency of identification became individualization.
Yes.
Non-identification became exclusion.
Right.
And needing better knowns became inconclusive. And
that's right.
It's like this gelling around, here are the terms that we're going to use now going forward.
Yeah. And it also happened right in that time frame of 2003 to 2005. When agencies that were accredited under legacy accreditation had to now stop using not identified because the assessors were finding it ambiguous, because it's ambiguous terminology, because that was the whole problem at the time. If you tried to narrow someone down back in 2002, 2003 and say, what do you mean by non-ident? Are you saying it's definitively not that person? Their answer could be, no, I'm just saying I didn't identify them. So it's not their print. Well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying I didn't identify them. Did you find anything matching? No. You didn't find any correspondence? No. So it's not his print. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I didn't identify them. That was the usage.
I'm not sure when that started with the accreditation bodies in general. I know it hit us in Arizona in 2010, 2011.
Well, you had to make the switch in 2005 because of the legacy switch was, I think, the ISO 2005, but not all agencies realized they needed to change that. So there was a shifting dynamic from 2005 through the accreditation cycle to 2009 or 10, whenever your cycle would come up. So there was this weird, right, this kind of overlapping grace period of, yeah, you're going to have to fix this.
And I mean, heck, I still remember hearing folks having to go through that change for years afterwards, right? So yes. Again, I'm not sure when it all started, but that's, you know, it didn't hit us until a few years later. But again, in that time frame, there's a lot of variation in what people meant by non-identification. Yes. And, you know, what the literature said versus in practice, and in practice in different parts of the country, you know, definitely lots of variation in what people meant when they're using the same term.
Right. And, you know, even in this case, since there were other exemplars that said need better exemplars, but those exemplars were either terrible or they didn't even have palms. So what it really seemed to be in application was the palms that were available for Webster were, as far as anyone looking at them, seemed okay. A comparison was done, but no correspondence was found. But the area where there was correspondence was not very clear in the Webster palm prints, and so it could easily be missed. But the examiner in the case did not ask for additional exemplars, and the reviewer, the verifier, didn't say, hey, you should probably ask for better palm print exemplars from these people. So it was verified. To me, this is just something that we talk about a little bit later in this, because the crux of how or why was it missed initially. But at the end of the day, I completely get it. You're doing your exams. You think you've got relatively decent exemplars. You've compared the area where you think it would be. You don't see anything. You're moving on. Non-ident. And I don't see anything matching, and I'm going to move on.
Right.
Of course, it's not an exclusion because it didn't exist back then. We didn't think that way, but it's being used almost as a de facto, this is a non-match, hence the term non-ident.
Right. So I'd mentioned that there was a CODIS hit in 2009. We can skip ahead a little bit. 2010, 2011 is when there's another round of comparisons. In 2012 now, there's a review of the whole case, including, you know, the investigator looking at, hey, there's CODIS hit here, and, you know, then looking at this list of suspects and going, oh, this guy is on the list of suspects, and his fingerprints were compared to this, you know, really probative latent in the case, you know, but not identified along with everybody else, all the 50 other people that were compared and not identified. So there's a request to look at this latent again, in particular, you know, with particular focus on these two people that have CODIS hits from DNA in the case.
Right.
So now after this other request comes in 2012, it's a little unclear, and I'm going to assume that some of the ambiguity in the report is because there's ambiguity in the case record. You know, otherwise I would assume that the report would be very clear on exactly when everything happened.
But sure. There's definitely ambiguity in the case record.
Sure. There's some minutiae marked out in a photograph. In the report, it mentions how there's examiner number one, and that's the person who did the 50 or so comparisons in 2010, finally reported in 2011. And now examiner four appears to be the person who may have placed these markings on the photograph as to where a bunch of features are. And there's not clear documentation for sure that that's who put those there.
Well, hold on. Yeah, I agree with you. There is no documentation who put those markings there.
Sure.
And this was a point of contention that, you know, RSNA contended that, well, this was examiner number four who did that. But there is no evidence that it was. And I actually talked to examiner number four. You and I both know him. And his response is, I don't remember. I don't remember if I don't know if that's how,
sure,
I normally mark or would have marked back then, but I don't have any recollection of that. I'm actually not convinced he's the examiner who marked that. There was Houston Police Department who had done exams in the case, and the markings are very similar to how Houston Police Department examiners did mark images. The reality was, we don't know because nobody put any initials next to the markings or said, these are my markings. So we don't know. Again, there's been some contention around this issue of, well, it has to be examiner number 4. I don't accept that. We just don't know whose markings these are.
The next thing in the case record is that on October 22nd, 2013, examiner number 4 reports out an ID of L1 to the left palm of Webster using a new set of exemplars. Now, it's unclear as to why a new set of exemplars was requested or if it just a different set was pulled for some reason at this point of the comparison or if there was an initial, you know, need better knowns to the old set of exemplars. It's unclear as to why another set of exemplars was used.
Yeah, the implication from, I believe, either from the record and some discussions with people at the time was that there was some potential correspondence observed with those original records that originally said non-ident.
Right.
So whatever about this examiner looked at the exact same materials and said, hold on here. There might be something here. Let's get additional exemplars. Asks for the additional exemplars and then is able to quickly make the identification, meaning that the exemplars showed that area that they were focused on. So, I mean, the implication is, one, they saw something that was either missed the first time, some potential correspondence, and enough to say, I need additional exemplars. And I hope that's actually the case. That's what I want to believe. There has been a suggestion from some parties involved in this that, well, were they just really biased to look at the individual because of the DNA hit? Was that affecting something? Did this examiner know that there was a DNA hit, so now they're extra focused? Like, I don't like that implication, but I also don't know that because, again, from the record, we don't know what anybody knew in the case or what they didn't know, if that was information that they would have had access to. We just don't know. I prefer the former explanation, but the reality is we really don't know why that examiner said, get me additional exemplars.
So, Glenn, when were these exemplars collected? Was there a specific request for, like, now here in 2013, you know, bring that guy in and get me new prints?
Well, that's, I think, another fascinating element of this case was because the original exemplars that they were using were taken in 2003. So these are the images they initially had, but turns out that the image that were requested later, they just went into the database and there were already other exemplars in there and they got a better copy of the left palm from 2001. It was actually an earlier set of palm prints. And that area is very clear in the exemplar, which raises another question. Why didn't it hit in the APHIS then? When they search it in APHIS, why didn't it hit?
I mean, there's multiple reasons for that. One, it was 2001 or 2010, and it was a palm, and it wasn't an IDEMIA or morpho or history of...
Subtle plug.
A little plug. But this was still early days of APHIS for palms.
Or did it hit? Because we don't have the candidate list. That's another thing not on the record. Was Webster in the candidate list?
Oh, good point. Good point.
Not part of the record.
Make sure those candidate lists are saved somewhere, people. I'm telling you, there's going to be a case where you go, oh, damn, we should have done that. I know there's a lot of agencies that make an extra effort to make sure those are kept, and others that it's just, well, it either saves it or it doesn't. And
they make extra effort to not keep them.
There's that, too. So it's verified, it's tech reviewed, it's reported out. Looks like the report is signed by Ron Smith as, you know, the owner of the company. Not that he did, you know, the specific examination in the case, it was just how they issued reports.
Yeah, that's another little interesting thing was, you know, Ron, of course, said at some point, you know, he did look at this because obviously there was this original, well, has another debate. Was it originally missed? Is that a technical error? Ron was very clear, like, well, it's not a technical error because it was a non-ident. And he wasn't being excluded. It was a non-ident. So it's not a technical error. Ron was very, very clear about this. I mean, I have had a different viewpoint, and, you know, we can agree to disagree on what that should be constituted as, given that the examiner number 4, using the same materials, ended up reaching a different conclusion, assuming, you know, that there wasn't any influence from contextual information in the case. So Ron signed the report. At some point, he has done an exam, but Ron's not in the case record anywhere. Ron, if he has an official conclusion, it's not known. But he did talk about during meetings that given that there was this, you know, issue between 2010 and 2013, you know, his what he implied was, well, of course I looked at it because I wanted to figure out did one of my examiners make a mistake in 2010. And his view was, no, he didn't. So my understanding is Ron looked at it at some point, just there's no record of it in the case record. But his signature is on the report, and that was standard practice apparently at the time.
So now we'll skip ahead a couple more years to 2016. This is when Joseph Webster goes on trial for the homicide. And it's the project manager from the work being done there in Houston from Ron Smith and Associates that goes in and testifies to the case. So not examiner one, who originally had non-identification on it, not examiner four that reached the ID with the new exemplars, not examiner five that verified it, or examiner six that tech reviewed it, but the project manager. And she said in trial that she independently compared the latent and reached an ID conclusion. And after that trial, Joseph Webster is convicted.
Yes, that's exactly right, Eric. One of the issues was that the project manager testified that she compared, identified it. And I don't dispute that at all. I, you know, from testifying under oath, I completely believe that. The problem is it's nowhere in the record. Nowhere in the case record is that she ever did an examination. There are no markings. There is no report. There is nothing to indicate. And I still, to this day sitting here, don't even know what year she did her technical review and ultimately identified it. Like, was it in 2013? Was it right before trial, 2016? I have no idea. And that was another issue, of course, that as the commission we had to deal with was, can you go to court and testify on something where there's no record of you ever handling any of the evidence or when you did or any of that? So it was another important issue to kind of unpack in this.
Yeah, it just seems crazy that to go into court, man, just the number of like walls and protections that we were under in Arizona when it came to court compared to what's going on here in this case just blows my mind. Like, so like even when I started like first day in 2007, it was very clear, hey, other agencies might do this. You don't do this. If they ask you, even with a proof of priors or pen pack or whatever you guys call it in your jurisdiction, it's a known print to known print comparison. If they ask you to compare it on the stand, you say, no, you're not going to do that. Because, you know, we have policy that has to go through evidence intake and has to be documented and verified and tech reviewed and admin reviewed and a report issued. It has to go through this whole thing. We couldn't even bring back evidence from a crime scene, right? If we went to assist at a crime scene, we'd bring our, you know, box and powder, the latents and collect the lifts. And then it was all, since we were at the crime scene, that was under control of a detective or crime scene analyst. They were in control of the evidence. So we were under their direction. We'd hand them here's all the lift cards that I took. You have to submit them to the crime lab. Like, there are just so many very clear rules as to what we're not allowed to do. And so I can't, it just boggles the mind of testifying without a report of what you've done.
So, yes, I obviously completely agree, but let me also throw out a couple of things. So at the time, Houston Police Department was not accredited. They were wanting to get accredited. And, you know, I don't recall this and because it doesn't really matter. I seem to recall, of course, RSNA getting accredited, but I don't know if they were accredited this time period. And it really doesn't matter because they were in this satellite contract thing. So even if they were accredited back in their laboratory in Mississippi and Florida in this time period, I'm not sure it really would have mattered because they were operating under Houston, right, rules, so to speak. And along with those rules, as Ron pointed out, was this idea of having the project manager testify for the case. This would have been agreed upon by the prosecutors in his jurisdiction for exactly as you pointed out, for time-saving money reasons that Who knows what's going to happen to all these different people in a case? You could have 12 people touching evidence in the case. So easy just to bring one person to come in and testify to everything that was done in the case. Although, again, there is a defense right to confront everyone who did stuff in the case, which, and here's an important point, was brought up as an objection in this case. Before this supervisor was going to testify, defense objected and said, we don't have a report from this person. We don't have anything from this person. Who are they? And the prosecutor during the trial said, don't worry, we'll cover all that. We'll lay all the foundation, and the judge allowed it. They never really did. I mean, they did and they didn't, right? You know, the other than the testimony saying, well, yes, I did this and I did that and I did that, and made it clear I did an independent examination, but did they really lay foundation through like chain of custody and through documentation and these other things? No, but did defense properly object to all of those other issues? This is actually one of the debates that came up later when this case is coming up in appeal issues about this right to confront, and did defense properly and fully explore this issue at trial? Because if they don't object, you can't make it an appeal issue, but they did object at trial. That's what makes it, from a legal standpoint, very interesting.
Right, right. So Joseph Webster is convicted at the end of that trial. In 2020, the public defender's office reaches out to Henry Swafford to take a look at a latent print here in this case. So Henry Swafford, I'm sure most of our audience knows Henry just from being in the field, but if you're not in the field, Henry had previously been employed with the U.S. Army Crime Lab. At this time, he was an independent expert, and he was brought in that capacity. He was the chair of the NIST-sponsored OSAC group that writes standards for the Friction Ridge Subcommittee within that group. Well-known, well-respected name in the field. Had he gotten his doctorate at that point in 2020?
Yeah, I think he had it.
It was right around there, just after it, is when he got that. I can't remember the exact dates, but you know, he'd gotten his doctorate from the University of Lausanne. So, you know, he's asked to take a look at this. So what Henry, he puts together an affidavit, and so Henry gets together this affidavit and sends it back to the public defender's office and includes how he went about this review of the latent print in this case. So what he ended up doing is, because he had been contacted by the public defender's office and had gone through presumably a whole lot of information about the case, he kind of knew a lot of details. You know, I would presume he knew about the CODIS hit and the conviction and just, you know, the nature of the crime, all sorts of stuff about it. So what he decided to do was to not directly do an examination himself, but to ask a few other qualified latent print examiners to take a look at the samples that he'd been provided, conduct their examinations, knowing nothing about the case or which case it is, just looking at the images, and send that information back to him. He'd compile it all together from these three different examiners, and then that is what ends up going into the affidavit. So in the report, you'll see that Carrie Hall is one of these examiners, and there's two other examiners. I believe they both worked for Houston Forensic Science Center.
Mm-hmm.
So as a quick aside, just as a note on this, you may be wondering why in some situations we're saying project manager, examiner number four, and in other situations we're saying Henry Swafford and Carrie Hall. So what we're doing here in the podcast is we're following the commission report, which was involved in discussions with all of the folks involved here in the case. And we're taking our cues from them as to when to use someone's name and when not to use them. That seemed like both the clearest way to proceed, so that if you want to read the report, you know, it follows along with what we're saying. But also, for whatever reason that they made those decisions, I'm going to trust the commission on that they had good reasons to make that call one way or the other. For me, I am not involved in it. So I know, Glenn, you were more involved. We'll get to that here in a little bit. But so I just kind of want to follow their lead on.
Yeah, that's very fair. There was a lot of background discussion about naming people or not naming people. I think it'll be interesting because there's going to be a couple of talks about this case at the 2024 Reno IAI, and one of the examiners from RSNA will be presenting on this case. I'll be curious if they name examiners in this. I'll be curious to see what they end up saying.
Right. So what Henry gets back from these three examiners is basically that none of them reached an ID in this case. So based on this, you know, lack of an identification from these three examiners, when there was one in the, you know, court record in the testimony, Henry stated that the examination and identification that was heard by the jury was not reproducible and therefore not reliable. Mm-hmm. So
comment on that, Eric. And I know you understand it because there was a huge misunderstanding of what that meant.
Right. So I think that the language is very carefully chosen there, or at least it seems that way to me.
And knowing
Henry, I can kind of guarantee that that language was chosen very carefully, that there was no statement that anyone reached an incorrect or erroneous conclusion here in the case.
Right.
I think it becomes fairly self-evident that when the original examinations back in the early 2000s failed to produce an ID, the re-examination in 2010 did not produce an identification. The comparison in 2013 did produce an identification, and possibly again in somewhere between 2013 and 2016 by the project manager. And then these examinations shortly thereafter again did not produce an identification. That seems inherently not reproducible of the same conclusion. And again, that's what's in the report, in this affidavit that Henry writes up.
Right. And the term reliability here being used as in the term of decision-making and metrology measurement theory means inconsistent. It does not mean inaccurate. It means inconsistent. In other words, exactly as you said, they could not reproduce. They could not get the same results as they were getting from 2013, that this was an identification. They weren't getting that result, so it was not reproduced.
So, you know, in 2022, this affidavit and a full-on complaint from the Public Defender's Office is sent to the Texas Forensic Science Commission as a complaint, because Texas has this process where you can file a complaint with the commission if there's some sort of issue with forensic science work in the state of Texas.
And the complaint was written by the defense attorneys.
Right.
Not by Henry. And there was a little bit of confusion about Henry saying these things, because there's some language in this complaint that, sounds like it was written by attorneys. And, you know, it has an element of advocacy to it. Whereas Henry's was very like, here's what the science, here's the test, here's the result, here's this. Here's what was said during trial. Here's what the standard is. And his was very cut and dry, black and white. Whereas the complaint is a little bit more, what's the word? Provocative.
Provocative. Okay. Yeah, sure.
I mean, the way the complaint is written is as if like there is a righteous indignation to this that, you know, he was clearly like railroaded. I mean, that's how lawyers are when they are, you know, arguing their element. They're advocates. They write in that element.
Right. So the complaint here is sent to Ron Smith and Associates. And one of the initial points that they raise is that the examiners that Henry had sent the print to, or Henry and those other examiners, may not have received the best quality images in the case. So now goes back to the Houston Forensic Science Center, who's, you know, now responsible for doing forensic work for the city of Houston. They produced the entire case file, and all of the images in the case is sent to the commission for review.
And to add to that, what Houston Forensic Science Center did was they have to go into like massive files in a warehouse and scan. Took them hours and hours and hours and hours of just menial administrative work. And just uploading everything into like Google Docs so they could be downloaded. I think it actually took me over 4 hours just to download the case files.
Wow.
I mean, it's a massive undertaking. And I want to shout out to Houston Forensic Science Center. And when you look at what happened because of the Houston Police Department and HFSC, I mean, kudos to this. I mean, we've talked about them before in other episodes.
Yeah.
But they really are a stellar organization that, you know, leading forensic science in the United States. And hats off for them for participating in this, getting involved and helping to sort everything out. So yeah, they had to go into these files to get all of these photographs, negatives, documents, like everything that was there, because what was handed over to Henry was basically a CD with seven images, and right. then some photocopies or digital images of some other documents in the case, pretty limited compared to what was in the original file, night and day.
So at this point, the commission brings in their own expert to help sort through all this. And I mean, I think you guys have figured out who that person is by now. So that would be you, Glenn, and hence the whole 4 hours of downloading everything, bringing you in to start taking a look at this case.
Yeah, so, I can't wait to start talking about it in part two.
And next time we'll start going through, you know, now the findings of the commission, what Glenn's opinion on some of this is, being, you know, so closely involved in this case. And then I think the most important part at the end of the report, this list of recommendations that the commission has for our field, especially in Texas, but you know, really nationwide, about what we can learn from this case and move forward with. And I mean, really, 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 that is the most important part of all of this.
It is. It's the takeaway is that let's use this case to improve our field. What can we learn from it and move forward?
I mean, if you guys have been listening for a while, you've heard me say before that the best thing that ever happened to our field is the error in the Madrid bombing case with the Brandon Mayfield print. Best thing that ever happened because so much good came from it. And you know, I can only hope that even a fraction of the good that came from that case, you know, comes out of this one. And there's some really good recommendations that we'll get to at the end of the next episode. And yeah, definitely can't wait to share that with you guys.
So not to be morbid, but Eric, we hit literally 20 years since the Madrid bombing. It was March 11th, and we're recording this on March 11th, and we're recording it 20 years later.
That is crazy. Yeah, 20 years ago, once AMA. That's definitely a sad day for Spain and sad circumstances all around. And you know, something good coming out of you know such pain is really all you can really hope for. So I know how much good came out of that and all the error and complications and pain with Mr. Mayfield and his family and everything. So I really hope that we can take this opportunity again. All right. So before we close out here real quick, I do want to mention a class that I have coming up. It's going to be real short notice. There's only a couple seats left, but in case you're just hearing about it now and have time to sneak in, I'm doing a class called Latent Print Exclusions and APHIS Solutions in Pennsylvania, Schwenksville, Pennsylvania, to be particular, April 15th through the 19th. So pretty short notice by the time this gets sent out, because it's just over a month away from right now when we're recording it. But if you're interested or able to attend, you can do a search for that class name, Latent Print Exclusions and APHIS Solutions, and also add in the word IDEMIA to find the class, or you can just email me and I can get you the information that way as well. I'm looking to do the class again later on this year. So if it's too late for you to make this class, if you're still interested, still let me know and I'll figure out and give out some information as soon as I figure out exactly where and when that next class is going to be later this year. Glenn, do you have anything you wanted to mention?
Yeah, it'll be also pretty close, but May 6th through the 8th, I'll be teaching in the SoCal area with Brendan Max and Kerry Hall on practical answers to challenging questions in the courtroom, our courtroom testimony class. I will also be, if we have any UK listeners, it looks like it's being confirmed, but the first week in July, that's July 1 through the 5th, I'll be teaching in the UK, my advanced ACE-V course, and that'll be like Southwest London area. So if we have any Brits out there listening, we'd love to see you in that class. And finally, I'll be teaching the advanced ACE-V class in the LA area, Los Angeles area, SoCal, and that is August 19th through the 23rd. Go to Ron Smith & Associates to register for any of those classes.
All right. If you have any questions for us, you know, please reach out Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, at eliteforensicservices.com or Eric at rayforensics.com. Remember, the opinions on this show are those of the speaker, not necessarily anyone that they work for. And with that, thanks, everyone, and have a great week. Can't wait for part two next time.
Bye, everybody. Have a great week.